From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents part four in a series of discussions about Afro-American culture, literature, and social order seen from historical and contemporary standpoints. The topic at hand is Afro-American slave narratives of the 18th and 19th centuries. The panelists are John Socorro and Darwin Turner. John Socorro teaches at North Carolina Central University. He recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a book about William Wells Brown and the Afro-American practice of narrative. Darwin Turner is a professor at the University of Iowa, where he serves as chairman of Afro-American Studies. Professors Socorro and Turner are co-editors of a collection of essays about the art of Afro-American slave narratives. Here is John Socorro.
You can look as early as the very early 18th century. Some people would date the earliest slave narrative from 1703. Mm-hmm. The first published slave narrative, generally recognized as the earliest distinctive separately published narrative, was 1760.
Is that unusual that something, that a slave narrative would be published?
It certainly is. It certainly is. In many ways, the easiest way I have of thinking of the early narratives is that they were, in a sense, written on the margins of the American history, American literature that was being written during mm-hmm. the 18th century. Figures like Britton Hammond and George White, a very significant man with a significant name, were asked to tell their stories, which became known as slave narratives, because their lives seemed to conform to a pattern of white writing at the same time.
Were they slaves?
They indeed were. Both of them certainly were. And the significant thing about Britton Hammond, the man whose story, life story, was printed in 1760, was that he was a slave who escaped and was then captured by Indians. Much of his tale is that of his captivity mm-hmm. by Florida Indians. The kind of tale that was very significant to Puritan readers in America in the 18th century, for they thought of their newfound land, their America, as a kind of garden in the wilderness. One way of establishing the beauty, the serenity of that garden, was to contrast it with the jungle outside. Mm-hmm. And life in Indian tribes was the closest, most immediate contrast that could be made. It's striking, of course, that the black slave narratives that deal with captivity during the 18th century always talk about Native American captivity and not Anglo-American captivity. But insofar as those lives were exciting, white publishers, printers were eager to have them.
This was like sensationalistic journalism, I would
think. In a sense, it certainly was. Many of them, particularly what one would call convicts' dying confessions, those were the most sensational, and it very often happened that the printers longed to have some blood still on the paper when they were getting dictation. Most of the narratives, maybe even through the Civil War, have similar titles. The Narrative of, mm-hmm. or The Life and Surprising Adventures of the Author. The kind of talismanic phrase that is first printed with regard to George White's tale is that it is the remarkable narrative of George White, comma, written by himself, mm-hmm. for he was the first American-born former slave that I know of who produced fully, who wrote fully his own narrative. That was published in 1805. George White was the first former slave, again, who wrote his own story. He had undergone a serious and exuberant conversion to Christianity. It became such a large fact in his life that he believed he had a vocation. So the inner light of God's word was in one sense opposing what one could take to be the outer light of American institutions.
The social circumstances that he was experiencing.
That's right. His life story, short as it is, plainly written as it is, and he says it's an artless story, but I think it's quite artful, nonetheless presents in very dramatic fashion the conflict, the tension between these two important institutions in America at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The light of inner rejuvenation through conversion and religion and God's grace on the one hand, and social institutions on the other. That's the underlying principle of early slave narratives, that so many of the humanitarian and religious and moral principles that slaves picked up either directly or indirectly conflict with the customs, laws, and codes of virtually all of America. Mm-hmm. It becomes the explicit theme of the abolitionist narratives that tend to dominate the form after 1830. Mm-hmm.
Darwin, you're interested in the structure of these narratives. What is it that do I have that right?
Well, that's part of what I'm interested in, and I'm drawing upon something that Arnabon Tom, a very distinguished black writer of fiction, poetry, and a literary historian, once said, that the antebellum slave narratives in particular, that is, the slave narratives that were written about a generation before the Civil War, seem to have four major elements, and two of those at least are significant in terms of the conversation that you were having with John. The first is a description of the conditions of oppression. Now, even though the former slaves who had escaped naturally talked about the beatings, they wrote also about the conditions in the lands in which they lived, and these were states in the South, states that were unfamiliar to many of the Northern readers. So some Northern readers may have had the same sense of excitement merely in reading the description of a different part of America,
mm-hmm.
that 17th and 18th century English and other European readers had in reading the travel tales about exotic adventures in America or in other strange parts of the world. A second section, or second element, of the antebellum narrative, I think, is extremely important because it may seem almost an impossible concept to some people. This is the question of how a slave comes to have the understanding, the belief, that he or she has the right to be free. When I try to explain this to students, they're often confused because, having been born free themselves, they believe, as one black man did who was captured when he was an adult and taken into slavery, they have the belief that everyone is born with the realization that he or she has the right to be free. But the question is, if one is reared in a society in which it seems that the religion is saying that God has willed you to be a slave for all eternity, the master who has power of life or death over you says that it is the will of society that you be a slave, and if even your parents and friends seem to agree, how do you ever come to have the understanding? For different slaves, the process was different. Nevertheless, it is of some interest to me, at least, going through these to try to see what it is that causes the individual to feel that he has the right to be free. The growing understanding that one has this right mm-hmm. to be free.
Mm-hmm.
Then the third, and this in many of the stories becomes most exciting, and this goes back to the conversation that you had, is simply the method of escape. The fact that one man, for instance, had himself sealed into a coffin and shipped north. Another couple posed as a white master with the wife, who was fair-skinned, playing the role of the master, and the darker husband playing the role of the dutiful slave. And they traveled in some luxury north as they went first class with the a slave husband, getting many compliments on his loyalty to his master and how remarkably he evidenced the loyalty of the really good slaves. These escapes were, for many readers, I'm sure, the exciting parts of the adventures. The escapes, together with the rather gory stories of the beatings, the very sentimental stories of the separation of children with parents, provided the kind of sensationalism that you and John were talking about earlier. But then the final section of the slave narrative is the contrast between the life that the former slave is living as a supposedly free man with the ideal of freedom that he or she knew before the actual freedom. That is, one is now North. Mm-hmm. Does North now mean merely freedom from bondage? Does North mean what perhaps it meant to the enslaved individual, a world where everything was going to be good?
How much of a literary form did this take? How widely was it read, and how was it distributed?
For the most part, you can talk about this with precision for the later or 19th century mm-hmm. narratives, later than the ones that I spoke about earlier. For them, distribution went on in churches, in anti-slavery societies, anti-slavery meetings. For the lecturers who went on the anti-slavery circuit, they would carry many volumes with them. Those who went to England would carry American editions to England. Those who wrote and worked in England would carry English editions back to the United States. So it is relatively certain that some reached as many as 40,000 copies in distribution.
How were they published, John? Pamphlets, books, broadsides? Yeah. What form did they take?
The range is from a single sheet broadside to a 2-volume, 800-page edition. Uh-huh. So the range is great. My guess for the 18th century ones is short, mm-hmm. relatively quite short, 14, 25 pages.
How do you estimate the audience? If, for instance, just hypothetically, we had 1 million Americans reading in the 19th century, in the middle of the 19th century, how many people would have been aware of slave narratives as such and taken them seriously? Any way to figure that out?
You can fairly easily discover the number of editions or the number of printings and the size of each. Mm-hmm. And to a large extent, the anti-slavery societies kept quite accurate records on where different volumes were distributed. So we know that. Moreover, we know the general composition of the audience. They tended to be Northeastern Americans, much touched by the Romantic Revival in America at the beginning of the 19th century. They tended to have evangelical religious motives, and, as Darwin suggested, a taste for, if not the sensational, certainly the extremely adventurous. And there was a kind of Gothic interest in one of those structures that Darwin mentioned, the savage beatings and savage
kind
conditions.
A kind of an otherness, an experience that was entirely foreign to them.
That's quite right. So the narratives provided basic information uh-huh. about experiences, lands, people they didn't know and didn't understand. But at the same time, they had familiar responses, familiar emotions that they knew from novels.
And what was the response? Was it disbelief? Was it political involvement?
I don't think it's too much. It's an exaggeration to say the slave narratives had a great deal to do with the Civil War, mm-hmm. with the ending of slavery. There is just no doubt at all that Harriet Beecher Stowe read carefully at least 7 narratives when she did Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Is it true that Abraham Lincoln said to her, "So you're the little lady who started the Civil War"?
It's certainly widespread legend.
Uh-huh. As a matter of fact, Harriet Beecher Stowe, as John would have pointed out, actually based Uncle Tom's, based the figure of Uncle Tom on a black man named Josiah Henson, who had written his slave narrative.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to part four in the Center's series of discussions about Afro-American culture, literature, and social order. The panelists are John Sikora and Darwin Turner. John Sikora teaches at North Carolina Central University. Darwin Turner is chairman of Afro-American Studies at the University of Iowa. Professors Sikora and Turner are co-editors of a recently published collection of essays about the Afro-American practice of narrative.
May I speak for just a minute on the presence of exclusion in considerations of literature and history? One could take it, that question, at virtually any point. I think that scholars of Afro-American history, particularly the slave trade, recognize that between 30% and 40% of all slave cargo, as the terms generally used, leaving Africa, didn't make it to their final destinations, however that would be defined. Perhaps it would be defined as the eventual plantation. Between 30% and 40% didn't make it alive. Count that number up over 2-3 centuries, and that's 10 to 15 million people. We don't hear about it in our schools or in our textbooks. That large number of people, men and women, have been written off. They don't make it into our history texts or into our literary texts. By definition, the slave narratives are written by men and women who did make it, mm-hmm. by definition, because they're writing. However, they do know from ancestral stories, stories from their own plantations, of many, many who did not make it, and they, of course, saw brutal beatings and murders. But that's one kind of exclusion. Another is, as Darwin suggested, think of the qualities you identify as specifically American about American literature or American history, whether it's courage, endurance, enterprise, intelligence, ingenuity, senses of harmony, in literary terms, of perfect stylistic grace, harmony of language, symmetry of phrasing. You can find all of those qualities in Frederick Douglass or William Wells Brown. You can find all of those in abundance in the slave narratives, as with, you know, most of Afro-American literature. So it is a puzzle, mm-hmm. in strictly literary or historical terms, why such important documents, texts, books, plays, poems have been neglected.
It's not a puzzle, John. It's blatant discrimination, is it not?
Yes, yes. And if you
that's what you mean when you say exclusionary.
But often with a disguise of rationality, the argument would be that one could not trust the word of a former slave because the slave would be too passionate about the experience. Mm-hmm. But one apparently could trust the word of the white master, because the white master would be more objective. I'd like to follow something that John was saying, again about exclusion. When asked why he wrote about the 19th century in America, Frank Yerby once said that individuals will accept criticism of their grandparents and great-grandparents more readily than they will accept criticism of themselves. I think there's an analogy between Yerby's statement and the reason that it is possible for this country, for example, to respond, I think, more easily to the idea that the Holocaust in Europe must be remembered than to the idea that there must be any memory of what happened to the slaves or to the Native Americans. Because as they look at the Holocaust, they can always, Americans, white Americans, can always say it was they who did something to the Jewish people, not Americans. Mm-hmm. But if they begin to talk about the experiences of the slave trade, then it is necessary to talk about what Americans, both Northern Americans and Americans from the South, did. I've used a familiar tale before about the father who reads to his son a story about a man who is on a safari hunting lions. And week after week, the son hears how the man killed the lions. And the son finally asks, "Daddy, do the lions ever win?" And the father responded, "As you know, they'll win only when they start writing the story themselves." Now, the black slaves did write the story, but the question is, how many people are reading it?
There are other ways of answering that question, Darwin suggested, but academics have to answer, I suppose, in the realm of ideas. But they also have to call our political leaders, our religious leaders, to task, to ask them to conform to those standards they ask the rest of us to. They, at the very least, at the very minimum, they have to know enough to make decisions, to make judgments. We've talked on other occasions about the present political climate. I think more knowledge, pointed knowledge, of things like the slave narratives is exactly what's called for. Then, after we know the knowledge is there, we have to demand that that knowledge be acted upon.
I'd like to take it back to the black community for just a moment. While I agree completely with what John's saying, I said earlier that I talk quite a bit about the creation of myths. We have in America the myth of the American cowboy. Now, the myth is quite different from the fact. The myth is that of the rugged individualist who somehow is able to stand alone against savage forces of humanity, against the savage forces of the land, and achieve something. Now, that myth is recognized, and certainly it can inspire people even in the highest political circles in the United States if the people are white. Why should not young black children then be inspired by the myth of the black slave, who at all costs, unable to trust black or white, was nevertheless able to escape, often on foot, traveling by night, 1,000 miles or more, to get to an almost mythic land called the North, a place that he or she had probably merely heard of, but could not even conceive of geographically. This kind of myth, and I'm using that in the most positive sense of the term, I think can be inspirational to young black children to encourage them to develop the concept that it is possible to achieve something, but to develop it in terms of what they can conceive of, because that Western cowboy may not be a very effective myth for the young black kid growing up in the inner city of Chicago.
I admire Darwin's conception of myth and its rejuvenating value for all of American society, and particularly for black children. Another sense that that myth would give to all of us is the removal of a falsely triumphal sense of all of American history.
This is what you call triumphalism.
Triumphalism, the sense that in all important ways, Americans have done all important things well and right and justly.
And it's all worked out for the best.
It's all been for the best, that's uh-huh. Right. In all things, we have been all good. That leads to enormous intellectual as well as political difficulties on every front. We are in the post-Vietnam era of some doubt of all of that triumphal view of history, but it is still, I believe, the ranking, the reigning conception of history. It is certainly that most junior high school and high school textbooks of American history provide. I am in a position to read many of those, and it is certainly the reigning one. What we need is a more ironic view. The view that I believe virtually every slave whose life I have read about was born with, an ironic view of his own life and the life around him. Seeing what is valuable and taking that, distrusting other public values that are often overblown, insincere, temporary, ephemeral, sold to somebody for some particular, often commercial purpose, and then discard it. The ironic personality, the person with a sense of himself and of his nation's history, is not liable to all of those faults of mind and action.
John, let me criticize that in theory and ask you to respond. What do you say to the argument that all kids aren't little English majors, they aren't going to respond to irony, and that there are a lot of parents who are going to say, wait a minute, I want my kids to get what I think is the truth?
I'm not asking that we plant irony.
Uh-huh.
I'm asking that we plant truth.
Uh-huh.
Truth is the tree. Irony, in my sense, is the fruit.
Mm-hmm.
It is that sense of the world and one's place in it that the mature adult develops. Not the original seedling. The seedling is historical truth as we know it. And Darwin has spoken well about how that should be inculcated at all levels for black and white children. Why, they would love the slave narratives. They are so adventuresome, so filled with vivid characters, memorable figures, memorable events. I know, because I have a couple of kids who grew up on them, that they are as effective as anything used in grammar and junior high schools right now.
Wayne, you've asked a question that leads to a response longer than the time we have remaining, because you've led into an entirely different subject, the question of the censorship of textbooks in America that is going on at present. And what you are raising actually becomes an issue for that must be taken up by English teachers, by history teachers, and by teachers in other fields, because there are certain individuals at present who are trying to make sure that most, if not all, of the textbooks adopted are textbooks that offer only their very limited views of what America is, of what American values are, and of what American history is. This is a very dangerous effort that really must be challenged and stopped by the academic world. Not to give just one view, and I'm certainly not suggesting that there should be just the view coming from the black slave, but there must be in education the presentation of the varied views of this pluralistic society of ours.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to part 4 in the Center's series of discussions about Afro-American culture, literature, and social order. The panelists were John Sikora of North Carolina Central University and Darwin Turner of the University of Iowa, both of whom specialize in Afro-American studies. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for part 4 in the Center's series of discussions about Afro-American culture, literature, and social order seen from historical and contemporary standpoints. This week, a conversation about Afro-American slave narratives of the 18th and 19th centuries. Why do these narratives merit popular and scholarly attention today? Two scholars of Afro-American literature, John Sikora of North Carolina Central University and Darwin Turner of the University of Iowa, have some answers and insights. That's Afro-American Culture, Literature, and Social Order, Part 4 in a series, this week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center on this station.